Hello and welcome to the latest episode of the Mirror Mall, the Daily Mirror's Six Nations podcast. I am host Richard Innes. I'm joined here by Gavin Allen, my colleague at Mirror Online.
Hello, hello.
Hello, hello. Proud Welshman. Not so proud this week. And, of course, as ever, Alex Spink, the Daily Mirror's rugby union correspondent and our resident expert. Hello, Alex.
I don't feel quite so much of an expert this week, having seen a couple of the results
that,
of the weekend.
I'm very glad you said that, because if I remember rightly, our last episode, we kicked off with a little jibe at Scottish weather and a little laugh at the expense of my beloved homeland of Scotland. And unsurprisingly, this week, I was really looking forward to the podcast.
I don't know what I got more wrong. The weather, which was spectacularly good for the 2 days I was up there. I've returned home to Tunbridge Wells today, and there's 6 inches of snow. So that is completely about face. Or indeed, the performance of Scotland, which was a revelation. England's performance was a revelation in many respects. But the Scottish one, from a positive point of view, my goodness me, they played the house down. Fantastic.
I think, and for people who are not regular listeners to this podcast, I am a Scotsman despite the London accent. I mean, it's hard to think of an occasion, and it sounds like hyperbole, but it's hard to think of an occasion on which Scotland have ever played better than that.
Well, I think, I mean, down the years, you will pull out individual moments of brilliance for Scotland, where particularly in this fixture, you know, where they have turned England over, 1990 and 2000. Being notable moments when they were given little chance and did so. But this was a really accomplished performance, because this wasn't a mugging. This wasn't Scotland getting lucky. This was Scotland bossing the game from the first minute to the last game. There was never a doubt that they deserved to win the game. And if you think that England were such strong favourites, they went in completely convinced that they had all bases covered, that they couldn't be ambushed, that they couldn't be surprised by anything that Scotland would do. It just makes the point that the Six Nations is unpredictable, wonderfully unpredictable, fantastically unpredictable, and, you know, why we all love it, why we keep coming back for more in these dark spring, wintry days when there's not a lot else happening. You get value for money from the Six Nations every time.
Indeed, and as we saw in Dublin as well, although Gav might not be too keen to talk about that particular match, Gav, or you know, how are you feeling about how the weekend went as a Welshman?
If I just stay silent and we'll move on, then, no, I was shocked more than anything. I was really, really shocked by the performance. I don't know tactically what was going on. I don't know how much of it was a tactical failure and how much of it was a performance failure. There were questions before and about whether Bigger would be attacking enough. We were absolutely dominated. We were swamped from beginning to end. And it looked to me a little like we thought we would welcome them onto us, throw the ball wide from near our try line and run them in, which we did late on. That game plan did seem to fire late on. But if that was a tactic throughout, it was insane, because
Shane Williams, I think, said on commentary, his kind of mask of objectivity slipped ever so slightly when, with about 2 minutes left, he said, "Where's this been for the last 70 minutes?
Yeah.
Because Wales started playing after about 75 minutes. It was bizarre.
It may just have been that Wales' fitness and bench gave them a little bit of an edge going in late on, and that game plan was able to be executed at that point. But if that, I'd be interested to know if that was a game plan or whether we were just dominated that much by Ireland. I mean, fantastic Ireland, the aggression, the drive, the desire, the skill. Sexton was magnificent. I know he missed a few kicks early doors, and I was sat there laughing, going, "Ah, that'll come back to haunt you on 87 minutes." But we got that wonderful, wonderful pass for the Jacob Stockdale try on 7 minutes, and some of his handling, some of his passing,
was just, and some of his tackling as well. Yeah. Smashing opposition forwards, backwards. I mean, he is some player, isn't he? Alex, Jonathan Sexton, any thoughts?
Well, I mean, that first pass in the first couple of minutes for the try was just delightful. His kicking wasn't great all day, but we just know that he is such a competitor. You know, he's there with Owen Farrell as you know, they are the two great competitors of European rugby. Absolutely fantastic. And of course, Rich and Gav, the upshot of Ireland's win is that they are now 5 points clear at the top of the championship. It does present us with the possibility, which nobody had really seen coming, that England-Ireland, far from being a Grand Slam decider as we thought it might have been, might almost be a dead rubber, because Ireland could have the championship won by the end of round four. And I know we've got a special guest with us today, haven't we? We've got Matt Dawson, well, England World Cup winner, Miro Colomis, to discuss this with us. And he's got some fairly good points to make on the subject.
Yes, Mr. Spink has been speaking with Mr. Dawson, as he pointed out, the regular columnist in the Daily Mirror, and has had a special chat with him ahead of the podcast to get his thoughts on the wonderful, wonderful, marvellous events at Murrayfield this weekend, mainly, and also the ramifications for the rest of the championship. So here is Alex having a chat with Matt just a little bit earlier. He had this chat in association with Instant Offices. So let's have a listen to what Matt had to say.
Okay, Dawson, thanks for joining us on the podcast. Well, Saturday surprised a lot of people, but not you. Headline on your Daily Mirror column, February the 2nd, Eddie's History Boys face a new threat from an old AULD enemy. Clever stuff. And on Saturday morning, these Scots are Finn with a chance. Reference there to Finn Russell, who you thought could be a danger, who was indeed man of the match. So were you surprised by anything you saw at Murrayfield other than the sunshine and the blue sky?
Yeah, do you know what? I was pleasantly surprised about Scotland's defence. I mean, listen, I know those guys can all make tackles and be organised, but it was ferocious, it was disciplined, it punched England drunk. And as much as we've seen England control games over the last 2 years, Scotland looked in complete control of the games, and the tries came from control by Scotland.
Yeah.
You know, they turned the ball over well. They finished off. They made clean line breaks. You know, scoring in the corner, walk-ins, but scoring in the corner. They rode a little bit of luck, but you have to in these games. And honestly, if at the end of the game you'd said all those players had black jerseys on, you'd have said, "Oh, textbook All Black performance." That it was that good for me.
The headline on the Mirror Match Report: Bowed Eddie's Army sent homeward to think again. And when we look back at the match, there will be people will say England were sloppy. They were perhaps complacent in discipline. 15 turnovers, 13 penalties conceded. The breakdown was a problem all match, wasn't it?
Well, it was the one disappointing part. Or standout disappointing part would have been for any, either Eddie or Dylan or anybody, an England player afterwards, to say, you know, around the breakdown, you know, we lost that battle. Or, I don't care whether you're in 2018 or 1988, you know Scotland are going to be ferocious over the ball. You know that they are going to be on the edge of legal. Look at the players that they picked. Look at the form of Watson and Barkley. You know what they're like over the ball. And I would have expected, the England camp to have been doubling up their rucks and making sure that at the very least they win their own ball and they try and compete for Scotland's. And they didn't. You know, they went in ones and twos like they have done in most of their games, thinking that teams are just happy to defend and step away and because they don't want to give penalties away, and Scotland turned it on its head. And what happens with that is, if Scotland get away with that in the first sort of 10, 12 minutes, and are very legal, which they were, then the referee is going to say, well, Scotland are good at this, and they're making the most of the breakdown, they're beating England, and then all of a sudden you can start tweaking the lines, so to speak, and Nigel Owens was relentlessly happy with the way that Scotland were at the breakdown and yet was penalising England off the park quite rightly because they were panicking and trying to scrape and scratch around to get the ball back. They were given a real lesson over that breakdown.
Yeah, you talked in your column on Saturday about the need for England to be able to adapt, and you drew parallels with your own experience in 2000, where it was very much a game of two halves, and you weren't as a team able, or you didn't adapt your game in the second half that day. That was a kind of reoccurring theme this weekend as well, wasn't it?
Yes and no. 2000 was mostly around the conditions. and it was the same for both sides. Scotland adapted better than us in the second half. I don't think I saw Scotland change their game plan particularly from minute one to minute 80. And yet, whether it was halfway through the first half, I would have liked to have seen after maybe 15 or 20 minutes, there's a lot of players with a lot of caps in that side, to huddle up and say, right, listen, we're losing the breakdown. Minimum, we go and smash every ruck that we have to win the ball, and we maybe pick and go through the middle. We win the rucks, we get a couple of penalties, we get a drop goal, we get ourselves into a position where we can 3-6-9, maybe nick a try, and we have the ball and we continue to have the ball and put pressure on Scotland. But that didn't happen. So, should that have happened at half time? Yes, absolutely. Scotland won the half time chat as well. And getting into the second half, England just had nothing left. Because when you're not running your own strategy and you're constantly having to adapt and change angles and go to places that you haven't practiced, it's absolutely shattering. And in the last 20 minutes, as much as England thought, well, we have a try and we'll get within three or five, they weren't running anywhere near where they were supposed to be running. And go again. I mean, Atoji, Laws, Lawchbury, they're our key runners. They were getting absolutely booped.
Final word on the game. The scuffle pre-match, any relevance or a storm in a Calcutta teacup?
I don't know. I think it probably would have riled a few. Absolutely no way. I think it was planned in any way, but they're the sort of moments where Bente before the game talking about history doesn't bother me and it's all about today's game. It's just the pitch with posts, and they're right, you're up, but things are going to happen that will test you that you've never seen before, or often not happens in the Six Nations when you play away from home. And there are some great lessons for England to take away from it. Scotland will move on from an emphatic win. England will move on, hopefully, realising that they've had a handful of games over this 2-year period where they've nicked and they've played really well and just won, but could have just lost. And the margin is very, very fine. And if they're not where they need to be, doesn't matter who they're playing, then they're going to get turned over. And so there's some great lessons for England to take away with and move on over the next year or so.
No bonus point for England. So 5 points adrift of Ireland in the table. Ireland beat Wales 37-27. England now play France, 34-17 winners over Italy. Just one thought on the way the table stands after three rounds to finish with.
Yeah, it was a key key moment. Not getting a bonus point, given where the championship now lies. You'd say England getting a bonus point in France is going to be a tall order. You'd probably like to think that Ireland could, I've got a better chance of getting a bonus point. Therefore, the championship could be over by round four. I wouldn't want that to happen, because it would be great to go to the last round with Scotland. If they happen to win in Dublin, they're in the mix. It's been a while. I think probably a couple of years, isn't it, since there have been two or three in the running. When Ireland nicked it after England couldn't quite get to France. It is a little bit of a shame that England didn't get that, because I think it would have made it really spicy until the end. There is, I'd say, a probably 50-50 chance that Ireland could have it wrapped up by round four. The championship had come to Twickenham looking for a grand slam, and England have got to spoil the party.
Wow. Well, you said it in your column time and again that the Six Nations delivers, that on any given day, any team pretty much can beat any other team pretty much, and certainly it was proved at the weekend. Dawes, thanks for joining us on this. It was much appreciated. We'll talk again.
Pleasure, Spinky.
Thanks, mate.
So that was Matt Dawson. Fascinating views. As he says, the championship could be over by the end of round four. 50-50 chance, in his estimation, that it will be. Again, some great lines in there. I think Scottish fans, Rich, you in particular, will love him saying that that was a textbook All Black performance.
Yeah,
it was that
idea,
good.
The idea that if we'd been in different coloured jerseys, you'd have thought it was the All Blacks. I don't quite know what to make of that, because I have to say, to hear, you know, an England rugby player talking about the Scotland team in that kind of hushed, revered tones, it's lovely, but it's almost a bit bizarre. It kind of goes back to listening to Jerry Guskett, you know, a man who, when I was growing up in the early 90s, shall we say, my dad was not exactly a fan of the Guskett and Will Carling midfield axis. And to hear, you know, in the same way that Matt's just talked about the Scotland performance there in very positive terms, to hear Jerry Guskett similarly after the match, discuss it, you know, being very open about how brilliant Scotland were and how Scotland deserved to win. It's all a little unsettling, if I'm honest.
I was just going to say, it sort of puts me in mind of Wales in the Euro 2016 Championships, that we're so unused to success, we're so unused to winning, that you don't actually, it defies analysis. There's no yeah. rationale for it. There's no consistency there. It's kind of like, well, let's just enjoy it while it's there, because I'm sure next week it'll be over.
Certainly for Scotland in Dublin.
But there's the challenge, guys, isn't it? There is the challenge for Scotland now, as it is for everyone else, but particularly for Scotland. You know, it's a glorious one-off, but it needs to be more than that to mean anything. It's all well and good for Scotland to beat England and for everyone to have a great weekend celebrating it, and for to having the one-off compliments that you look like the All Blacks for 80 minutes. I mean, fantastic. You dine out on that. But in professional sport, it's about consistency. It's about being able to replicate that the following week. And, you know, and Matt, in his interview brought to us in association with Instant Offices, he did make that point that, you know, this is a Scotland team which could have more to it than just that sort of one-off ability. They've got a great coach in Gregor Townsend. You know, we have acknowledged that for a couple of weeks, that opening day defeat against Wales, that heavy defeat to Wales, really didn't kind of represent the sort of the brain matter and talent that Townsend brings to coaching. And we've finally seen it now. But can they do it again? They've got Ireland next. That all of a sudden is a huge game, isn't it?
Well, it's home versus away as well, isn't it, Alex? In the sense that the France game was about Scotland getting back on their feet, getting back on the horse, and that was in front of a Murrayfield crowd. And now they've done, you know, put in this amazing performance in front of a Murrayfield crowd. But when you compare that to what happened in Cardiff, can they now go to Dublin and you do it away from the home fans? That would be my big concern.
And their away form is not good. You know, it compared to the way they play at Murrayfield, it is not good. So that, you're quite right, that is the challenge. I remember back to, I'm just referring to it, I think it was last summer they were away on tour. They went to Sydney, Scotland we're talking about here, went to Sydney, won 24-19 on the 17th of June. 7 days later, they lost to Fiji. Albeit away from home again, but there you go. That's the inconsistencies we're talking about.
And I do wonder if there's a bit in the Scottish game, which, you know, which we saw on at the weekend, about the pace and the intensity. That is such a key part. You know, they tried to keep England on their feet, keep moving around, keep the game flowing as fast as possible. And I think they take so much from the home crowd that allows them to do that. I think when you're away from home and you don't have the crowd to give you that extra surge to keep you going. You know, when the ball's been in play for 3 minutes solidly and you're trying to suck in some air and you're looking for that little bit of inspiration that can get you to the next breakdown as quickly as humanly possible, I think it's a bit easier to do that at home than it is away. I don't know if that's oversimplifying, but that's always been my impression.
I think the what's very useful for Scotland is that they're playing Ireland next and they will again be underdogs. So despite the fact they've just beaten the number two side in the world, handed them only their second defeat in 26-27 games, they will go to play Ireland as underdogs. And the underdog tag, we talked about it last week, we can talk about it every year for the rest of our lives, it remains true. For Scotland, they love the underdog tag. It brings the best out of them. And the fact they've got that again makes that a very, very interesting game.
I'm just going to posit something here.
Oh, here we go.
I know that we didn't have the best of weekends, but let's not forget that Wales could very easily have won that game in the last 5 minutes. Had things gone slightly different. We weren't dead and buried, despite the fact that it was a poorer performance.
Well, Rich, we said we thought it could come down to Ireland winning by 3 points, and it was looking like 3 points until the interception at the end, wasn't it? So, but you're quite right, Gaff. There was every chance that Wales could have nicked that, and despite not really playing that well, they kept themselves in the game throughout, which is the sign of a decent team.
Yeah. There is actually still a way that Wales can win this championship.
And is that if the championship is cancelled, or act of God? Or
I'm indebted to my old friend Dami Parfit for this down at Wales Online. But Wales need to beat Italy and France, right? And that's a given. That's virtually already happened. You may as well give us the points, and we'll have some bonus points for that too. We need Scotland to beat Ireland in Dublin, right?
Okay.
Now, after the weekend's performance, surely, Rich, you can organise
possibly,
that.
But you'd need us to beat them by more than seven, presumably. So.
Well, once the table start turning, we'll see where the bonus points fall.
Okay.
Scotland beat Ireland, and then France to beat England in Paris on the same day.
Yeah.
I mean, England in disarray after that performance, surely. You know, struggling, I would say. France, back, they've got those 9 players back, maybe.
This is the sound of the whole of Wales clutching at straws, is that sound you can hear in the background?
Then on the last weekend, we just need, you know, Scotland to get beaten by Italy.
Right. Okay.
Possible.
Possible. Always, but it has happened. Yes.
Huh? And pretty much everybody would have lost 2 games after that. And once the tables start turning, start going down. Who knows what's going to happen? So I'm far from down over the weekend. I'm exceptionally chipper. That is virtually nailed on. I'm not a betting man. I am going to put
obviously.
I'm going to put £3.50 on this.
So your suggestion is that we could be going rather, you know, because obviously we've just heard Matt describe how he's concerned that the championship might be over going into the final weekend. You're taking a quite contrary position in that we could go into the final weekend with 4 teams still in the run for the title.
On the 17th of March, you will be shocked at the winner of the Six Nations.
Right, okay. Well, you heard it here first, folks.
You made an interesting point, though, Gav, talking about whether this is more than just a single defeat for England, whether it kind of highlights, flags up deep-rooted problems within the team. And I guess that's the big test, because while I think we do perhaps get a little bit carried away when England lose a game because it happens so rarely, so perhaps I think the reaction is far greater than it is when most other teams drop a game. Nonetheless, they have got some pretty key issues to look at coming out of this game. I mean, Matt talked about Scotland's ferocious their ferocity and discipline in defence, but he also talked about England's inability to react to the game plan, which didn't really change through the game. You know, they were given a lesson in the breakdown.
Sorry, Alex, I was just going to say, I thought it was very interesting what Matt made the point, and it, particularly coming from a guy who was a scrum half in a World Cup winning team, and we know how scrum halves like to think they know everything about the game and therefore will pull, you know, anyone who's played rugby will know that the scrum half's the one who's telling everyone what they need to do. So Matt will have been in that exact position in international matches where if plan A isn't quite working, he would have been part of that senior team, part of that England side back then, that would have got guys together and said, right, what are we doing here? Why isn't this working? You do that. You do that. Let's rethink this. And that just didn't seem to happen on Saturday. They seem to just keep plodding along.
And the interesting thing is, the interesting thing is that Eddie Jones has talked ever since he came in about there being a kind of deficiency of leadership, about England not having enough leaders, about the need to be able to build that bank of leadership so come the biggest games, they are able to adapt on the field. Now, in the last 3 or 4 weeks, he's been far more complimentary about the amount of leaders in the team. He's felt that they've really made strides in going down that road. And yet, on Saturday, there was a leadership issue. Clearly there was. There was a deficiency of it. And so, you know, again, they've got to go back. They've got to look at Dylan Hartley as captain. Is he still the man to lead England forward? A lot of people champion the cause of Owen Farrell, who's very much the spiritual leader of this team. Do you need to give him the armband to make any difference? I'm not convinced you do, but it's become an issue again. Leadership has become an issue. Selection's become an issue. All of a sudden, a lot of things are being thrown up in the air albeit on the back of just one defeat.
And there's also the issue that you talked about Dylan Hartley, you know, the fact that you got Jamie George sitting there on the bench, you know, Lions hooker, like trumping at the bit to get his chance in, you know, in the first team. If you were a betting man, would you say Dylan Hartley will still be the England captain at the World Cup?
I think that depends as to how England come off the back of this game. Eddie Jones isn't one to panic. He's not. He won't panic because of what happened in Scotland. He will. He's very measured. He deals in analysis. He'll look at the numbers. He'll look at everything that went on in the game, and he'll look at it in the cold light of day. A lot of us get quite emotional about these things. You know, the way we, you know, the way we react at the time, the way we're kind of taking the game to pieces now in our analysis of it. He will do it in a very scientific way. I think if England don't turn it around, I mean, were they to lose to France in Paris next week, which is possible because France are not a good team. They've just ended 9 games without a win. But nonetheless, they have done that. It's given them a bit of confidence. They're at home. This is their big fixture of the championship. Were France to win that, England would then lose 2 in a row, taking on Ireland, who might be going for a Grand Slam, could be 3 in a row. This is the doomsday scenario. Now, were that to happen, were England to finish 3rd or 4th in the championship coming out of it, then all of a sudden you're looking at Dylan Hartley in a different light from when he was captain of a side that won 24 out of 25. So it's too early to make any sort of conclusions on what the future might hold. But it just goes to show that these next couple of weeks are very, very important.
There are a couple of issues that surprised me for England. One was, we can say that Eddie Jones is scientific and will look at the numbers, but he would have been doing that via a laptop during the game. He didn't react, and I was quite surprised at that. And it's that difference between implementing a game plan or performance. Was he asking for something that he couldn't get? Was it just complacency? Because it's very hard to kind of look at that performance and say Scotland was suddenly shockingly that good, but they weren't allowed to be by England. I mean, England's discipline was appalling. There were some penalties going in that you're shaking your head while you're watching it happen. I think England are a good team at the moment, but they're not a great team, and that's partially down to the leadership issue. You have to go through these things to come back and be stronger and to get there. I'm not sure they're quite there yet. They will become, you know, a very, very good side, I think. It depends on the bounce back, because it depends on how damaging this is for the side.
Yeah, I had an interesting conversation with Neil Back, teammate of Matt Dawson, obviously, in that England side that won the World Cup in 2003. And to quote him, he said, "Mentally, we weren't right," referring to England. You can't turn up to any game in the Six Nations and think you're just going to win and move on to the next game. The players, to a man, will say, "I didn't feel like that." But that feeling must have been in the camp, or they wouldn't have performed how they did. Yeah. They weren't where they needed to be.
And now, you can maybe believe that. You can maybe, it is possible, of course, to genuinely believe within yourself. You can tell yourself, no, I'm ready. I'm preparing properly for this match. I'm an international rugby player. But at this level, at test match level, you only need to drop your levels by, you know, a few percentage points, and that will make all the difference. And that it may be purely subconscious, but perhaps that's what's happened.
Yeah, but I mean, the positive for Back out of that defeat is that he draws parallels with 2003, when England dropped an away game to France. It was their penultimate game before going to the World Cup in Australia, and they picked largely a second team for it. But they were on a run of 15 straight wins, and they clearly wanted to go into the World Cup without losing that run. But they did. They lost the game in Marseille, and he says that at the time it felt, you know, pretty devastating because they wanted to go in with the momentum. But actually, with hindsight, it grounded everyone. It grounded everyone. And everyone reset the dials going to Australia. They realized that winning games and winning the World Cup wasn't a given. They were going to have to work. It was a useful reminder. And it may very well be, because England are not a bad side. They've got great talent. It may well be that this is just a wake-up call, which is going to sharpen them and set them on another unbeaten run.
So you could see this ending up, you know, we could be looking back on this in a couple of years saying this was a bit of a turning point, potentially.
Well, I think it's entirely possible that we can look back on this game as a wake-up call that reminds England that just that extra 1%, 2%, which they dropped off individually, each of them dropped off their performances at the weekend, that you can't afford to do that. That if they get their game A on the pitch, that they're going to be very hard to beat against anyone in the world. But if they turn up with game B, it's a different matter altogether.
You know, we were talking about, Matt was talking about the incident in the tunnel before the match, which was quite unusual because, you know, I can't really remember a lot of incidents similar to that in Six Nations
history.
It
happens in football, doesn't it?
I mean, it's something you see in football. Yeah, I always think of the Roy Keane and Patrick Vieira moment before the Arsenal-Man United game in the great days of that rivalry. And we've never seen anything quite like that in rugby. Now, I know Matt said that while it probably didn't affect the game directly, you know, it certainly would have riled a few people up. And could it be that was something that worked, you know, in Scotland's favour and maybe, you know, or was it a case that England players maybe lost their heads? Because, you know, Gav's mentioned there the discipline, the number of penalties they gave away was astonishing. Could it be that there was a bit of a loss of composure at that point?
Well, I would subscribe to that view based on the fact, not just having seen what happened, which you could dismiss as something and nothing, but given that England started so poorly and given that Scotland, who are just dreadful starters, they get left in the stalls before most games going in the first 20 minutes, they started superbly. By halftime, Scotland had scored 3 tries. They hadn't scored a single try against England since 2004 at Murrayfield. So England clearly weren't right. Now, people will advance a lot of theories as to why that may be the case. But, you know, I would say to you that to see Owen Farrell react the way he did and for it obviously to kind of rile up a few people and get everyone going would have affected both sides. And it's quite possible that Scotland either pre-planned it, but whether they did or not, took something out of the fact that they tugged the tiger's tail and they got a reaction before the game. It might have empowered them.
Yeah, it might go down. I remember that wasn't the thing. Was it 1990, the Grand Slam game where David Soul was a Scotland captain that day and the boys walked out? There was no run out onto the pitch. There was the slow march out onto the pitch. And it may well be that people will look back on 2018 and say this was a similarly kind of orchestrated way of making sure you got under the English skin, you know, as you say, tugging on the tiger's tail.
What about 2003, the Grand Slam decider in Dublin when Martin Johnson led England out and they went to one side to meet the Irish president and were told after they got into position that they were on the wrong side of the halfway line. And he said, nah, we are not moving. We are
here. They made the president walk through the mud, of course. Yeah,
exactly right. And, but that sense of defiance was then taken into the game by England and they won a Grand Slam decider against an unbeaten Ireland side by 40 points.
I'd be claiming that as a coaching masterstroke right now, whether it was or not. I'd have my hand in the air.
I'll have that one. Thank you.
Any qualms about the refereeing? It seems like it's just been me so far complaining about the standard of refereeing in this tournament. Again, I thought Wales versus Ireland, inconsistent offside coming in at the breakdown. We got murdered at the breakdown. Dan Biggar got taken in the air by a clearly wasn't given the decision. There's been a lot of criticism of Nigel Owens over the England game. Any thoughts on that, Spinker?
I think what goes around comes around in most of these games. England got the rub of the green when they played Wales. I mean, that, as you will tell us, if I don't get in quickly with it, Wales could well have won that game and had ample opportunity to, but had a couple of things didn't go their way. And I think, you know, you'll find that luck that England had that day at Twickenham kind of deserted them, didn't they? They had 2 tries chalked off. Certainly one of them, which came from a blinding Courtney Laws tackle, which popped the ball clear, which was ruled a knock-on, which then meant the try was called back. Well, you know, people do look at that law and think, goodness me, that's a nonsense. It was a great tackle. The ball popped clear. This should be advantage given to the, you know, to an aggressive attacking tackle like that, but it wasn't. It went against England. They had 2 tries disallowed, and there's the ball game.
And so, in fairness, Alex, on that particular one, that you can't really blame Nigel Owens on that because that's the sort of fault of the rule, isn't it? Should perhaps. I agree with you. You know, it seems bizarre that you get punished for smashing an opponent legally and so hard that he spills the ball. But that was just Nigel Owens implementing
the
rules.
That's the law.
I thought Nigel is the referee from heaven. He should referee every game. He's brilliant to,
do you know what,
to
I,
listen
I,
to and to watch.
Yeah, exactly. I was just going to say, the thing, I mean, as caught up as I was in the game, as everyone else involved in watching a Calcutta Cup match should be, I often think to myself, it's like the match is the film, and Nigel Owens, his commentary is like the brilliant DVD extra. You know, like you could actually, yeah. I would sit there. You could almost do a podcast just purely of the audio of the referee's mic from any match Nigel Owens takes.
We could ask him to do. We could ask him to do a commentary to go on the DVD of this.
Absolutely,
when it's given a release. I think
he's absolutely fantastic. The way he talks to these giant, huge, hulking figures around him like he's a school teacher telling off some naughty schoolboys. I think it's fantastic. Clearly, the players have an enormous amount of respect for him because he doesn't get a lot of back chat.
No, I mean, he is the world's number one referee. I don't think too many people would argue with that. People love his communication. You know, occasionally somebody pulls him up for it and says, come on, you're showboating a bit. But I think that's largely unfair. We're in an entertainment business. He referees clearly, concisely, and he communicates with the crowd, you know, brilliantly well, whether you're watching it on TV or whether you've got the little machine in your pocket at one of the stadiums, listening to it through headphones. It's an entertainment business, and we can't, you know, while you've got to get it right, and he gets it right far, far, far more often than not, he also entertains, and you know, all power to his elbow.
Indeed. So, well, look, let's look forward a little bit, because obviously we've got another rest week. I always find it quite odd, this sort of setup, that you get two massively intense test matches. So you've got players, you know, with limbs virtually hanging off after two incredibly intense matches of rugby, and then you give them a week off, and then they play another one, and then they get another week off, and then they've got to do the double header again. It seems a bizarre, kind of bizarrely unfair way of treating their bodies.
Well, the championship's taken place, as you just pointed out, over 7 weeks. I know the English clubs would like to cut it down to 5 weeks, just bang, 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 the five games week on week, but quite rightly they've been told to get back in their box, that this is... We're talking a high attrition. And also, isn't it nice that you come out, occasionally you just come up for breath? You know, we get the chance this week to reflect and talk about what was a pretty epic weekend, you know, across the piece last weekend, and to look forward to next week. We've got some pretty dodgy weather down south this week. England were supposed to all be in a training camp in Oxford, but because of the various travel problems, I think only 19 of the 27 will now go to Oxford. They were using other four other regional venues for players who can't make it there to go through their own training and their own reconditioning work. So the players need time to patch themselves up, because traditionally, as it always is, we finish with back-to-back games, and there are big ones. You know, England playing France and then Ireland in the space of 7 days. That's going to ask a lot of their bodies.
Have you got any insight, Alex, into whether the schedule for England over the next 2 weeks will have changed on the basis of the result in Edinburgh?
I don't. Well, listen, I'm sure they'll tweak bits, parts of it around the edges, but fundamentally, they're always planning to go to Oxford. As we've talked about before on the pod, when England aren't in a test match week, they vacate Pennyhill Park because Jones wants that to be special. He wants that to be the test match venue. When you're in there, you know you're building up to a big game on the weekend. So he's taking them out of there. This time, they're not going to London as they did a fortnight ago. They're going to Oxford. Amongst the dreaming spires, they will be there to reflect on what went wrong and what they need to put right. They're there for most of the week. We're going to see them on Wednesday. Weather permitting, they've got a big training session the following day, and then they will get serious and start focusing in on France and deciding whether they need other players. They named a squad last night. They've added Elliot Daly to the squad, who we all know, wonderful player, British and Irish Lion, regular through, ever present throughout that series in New Zealand last summer. So having him back will be a great addition. They've also brought in Carl Sinclair, the kind of feisty young prop, another ever-present, albeit off the bench for the British and Irish Lions last summer. So two strong men to come back, shake things up, freshen things up a bit, Rich. And so I think England, you know, they'll be all right. They'll turn it round. They've got a shot. They've got a week to kind of to lick their wounds and to refocus. Let's talk about whether Scotland can tap into what they did at the weekend, whether they can actually believe what they did at the weekend, and if they did, whether they actually stopped for long enough to put a cork in the bottle and keep some of it for the future. What do you
bloody
reckon?
Well, hope so. Oh, well, bloody well hope so. But I do fear what might happen in Dublin, actually. But for the simple reason, I mean, you gave the good example of last summer, you know, the Australia game followed up by the Fiji game. And I'm just not sure if Scotland have the mentality that will see them sort of use this as the kick on. As much as I'm sure all the players will be saying the right things and thinking the right things and doing the right things, I just can't see how you can maintain the intensity that they showed in those 80 minutes. People always talk in various sports about how you can't just turn it off and turn it on again. And the idea of just going back out there again next time round and replicating that in Dublin, that's what they're going to have to do. Whether they can actually do it, remains to be seen.
I think the illustration of that is already there, because you had some great performances in the autumn internationals. You came into this championship with people saying that you were favourites against Wales, and you know we were going to struggle against you. And with that pressure on them, with that possible favourites tag, look what happened. Looking at this side, you sort of think that the Ireland game is just going to kind of be after the Lord Mayor's show, really. Have they got what they wanted out of this championship? Have they got what they're going to get?
Possibly. And a lot of will rest on Finn Russell, really. A lot of it just depends on him. You know, there were moments in that first half against England where he wasn't perfect by any means. You know, there were certain things I think he made a couple of basic errors. And even that miracle pass, which set up, I think, was it the second try? The pass off his left hand, the big loop pass.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, if he gets that, he only had to get that a little bit off, and Jonathan Joseph is in under the posts. You know, that was literally inches away from being an interception. And of course, if that happens, the entire game turns. England are back in the match, and I would have thought we would have ended up losing that game. I mean, that's the margins you're talking about, and that's the way Finn Russell plays. That's how he has to play. So you're always, you know, that at the risk of sounding pessimistic off the back of a fantastic weekend, you're with Finn Russell, you're always just those few inches away. I mean, that's the nature of his game. That's what makes him such a wonderful player. But it does mean that things can go wrong quite quickly.
Let's remind ourselves that Scotland beat Ireland last season, albeit it was at Murrayfield. And we've already talked about how much of a home team Scotland tend to be. But yes, they did win that game last year. And let's also remind ourselves and not forget the fact that Ireland failed to score a try against France, were lucky, you could say, to beat them. Well, not lucky, because Sexton's drop goal was a masterpiece, but you know what I mean? They took it right down to the last kick of the game to win it. So they got away with that one, dodged the bullet, if you like, in that one. And against Wales, you know, they might have lost that game as well. So Ireland aren't sweeping all before them, but they're showing that ability which great sides have to find a way to win matches. You can go to the well once too often with that, of course, and maybe it'll be that next week a pumped up Scotland will do something special. I mean, Stuart Hogg has played well for Scotland. Most people think he's their number one player. He hasn't had a vintage championship yet.
No, maybe
next week's going to be the time that he shines, that he goes the length and sets up a try which does it. You know, Greg Laidlaw's not going to miss many kicks, we know that. So they might quite fancy themselves. It's the Six Nations, and we can go around the houses making cases for everyone, because it's that standard of competition. But I certainly am not as quick to write off Scotland's chances as you, Rich, will be very happy to do.
You know me too well, Alex. You know me too well. off the back, going back to what Matt said earlier on in his interview for the podcast, he was talking quite seriously about how the way the bonus points are falling or not falling, we could end up with a situation where, you know, Ireland could be champions after this week or next weekend, after the next set of fixtures. What are your thoughts on that, Alex, specifically, like in terms of prediction wise, do you actually see that coming to pass?
Well, they're leading by 5 points at the moment, aren't they? So they're 5 points clear of the table, which means that if England stutter at all, in France, if they draw it or if they fail to win it, then in all likelihood they're going to be out of the championship, and that will hand Ireland, if you like, a pretty free run the following weekend. I somehow feel that England will find a way to beat France. They've got a really decent record against them. They've won 9 out of the last 11 fixtures against France, and France are fairly shambolic.
But are England in a position, Alex, where they have to score 4 tries in Paris now?
Well, it will certainly help their cause, and I think if they're looking to win the championship outright, I think they do, because you know their points difference isn't sensational, and so if they're going to be level on points with Ireland, you know they're asking themselves a question as to whether that's going to be good enough. And I'm just looking at the table now, and when you see Ireland's point difference 49, Ireland's point 49, and England's is 25, so they do have ground to make up. I think they will certainly feel that they need to score the four tries, but as soon as you start planning on having to do that, things can turn ugly. They've
it's
got
a
to win the
business, isn't it?
Yeah, you got to win the game first. Listen, broadly speaking, I think there's a fair chance that this championship will go to the final weekend, but I think if it's not a fatal blow that Scotland have dealt England, it's close to it, because unless they can repeat the dose on Ireland and then even things up, Ireland are in a very, very strong position.
It would be remarkable, wouldn't it, if Scotland, of course I would say this, but if Scotland could win in Dublin, that would actually be the best thing for everybody, wouldn't it? Because you'd then have a situation where, presuming that England could get the job done to an extent in Paris, you do then have a three-way race for the title.
Well, I'm with you. We've already agreed this is
going to happen
anyway.
I beg your pardon. According to Gav, we have a four-way race for the title.
Yeah.
Going into the final weekend, which would be remarkable.
Well, Wales have got probably what look on paper to be the two easiest games of this championship for them. We've already played Ireland, Scotland, and England. We've got Italy. You know, no disrespect to them, but the likelihood is that we'll beat Italy. The France game we should win, even if it just comes down to a fitness fight. We may finish putting some points on the board. We may finish looking a little bit better than we feel right now.
And you've already got a couple of bonus points.
Yeah, It's not going to go down, I don't think, as a terrible year for us, but it sort of feels that way right now. It feels like we've got worse as the championship has gone on, unfortunately. The first two performances I was quite happy with, even within defeat. I was sitting here and arguing the merits of our team, refereeing decisions, things got against us. It felt like a slight injustice that we were sat there having not won the England game. But the weekend was just a strange, strange performance from us.
It was a strange weekend. Refereeing, the discussion around refereeing performances, it definitely feels to me, and you'd be a better position than I, Alex, to know, to have an answer on this, but it feels to me like referees, the kind of tone of the conversation around referees within rugby has changed a little bit in recent years, in the sense that when you're watching something on TV, the commentators and pundits still kind of talk, as respectfully as possible about refs. But that kind of social media influence is kind of coming in, and you're having now a situation where pundits are having to address all the various, well, the many, many complaints that fans tend to have. And it seems to be the conversation is getting a bit more like the one that you might have in football. Do you think that's fair?
I think the conversation on social media is, but I still think that rugby polices itself pretty well. There is the demand for respect is there, and if people fall foul of the referees or are seen to be behaving in a way unbecoming, then rugby does still tends to root that out and not tolerate it. I think rugby is pretty fortunate. I think the top tier of rugby referees are a very high standard. Wayne Barnes of England is a magnificent referee and communicator. And Nigel Owen, we've already talked about, again, ticks both those boxes. A couple of the French guys are a very high standard as well. You know, rugby is pretty well served by its referees. And while there will be, social media is just an opportunity to rant about the world in every aspect, isn't it?
That's a whole separate podcast, isn't it? Yeah.
Well, but it's true, isn't it? I think you have to divorce yourself from the kind of screaming banshees. Actually look at things. And I think in the main, the referees get far, far more right than they do wrong.
I think Paul O'Connell summed it up very, very nicely, actually, when I think somebody asked him at the weekend. I think he was asked about Nigel Owens' performance. And he said, look, the way rugby works, at every ruck, you could say it as a penalty for your side. At every single breakdown, there is someone on a fan of one or the other team would be able to say that's a penalty for us because offside, because going off the feet, because coming in at the side. There's always going to be an argument for it. So it's a bit of a thankless task, isn't it?
Unless you're a New Zealand VAR referee. Sorry, not VAR. No.
The TMOs from New Zealand, yeah. Yes. Well, probably less said about that, the better. I suppose we're probably coming to the end of this particular podcast, Alex. But what, again, as I always ask you, with this fallow week we have, where are you going to be? Are you going to be up and down to Oxford following the England team as usual?
Yeah, well, we'll be with Oxford on Wednesday and Thursday. I'm then taking a little bit, three, 4 days off the rugby beat to cover the World Indoor Athletics Championship in Birmingham this weekend. before getting stuck back into it. England's build up at Penny Hill Park next Monday. So that's my plans, given the weather, the possibility and the likelihood and the opportunity to go inside for the Athletics is quite well timed.
Yeah, you've got your own little... I'm sure the players will be getting a couple of days off here and there, so you've needed it as well, just to recharge before the European-wide trek continues.
I think we all do. I think we all need that slightly, you know, because, you know, we love talking about it and we love watching it and we love everything that goes around the championship, the whole circus of it. But it's important occasionally just to kind of stop for a minute and let it breathe. Otherwise, it really is gone before you know it. And it's a shame because it's one of those things that you like to savour it as it goes along rather than just see it flash by.
Yeah, and actually, yeah, particularly when you've just beaten England at Murrayfield and you get an extra week to bask in the glow and the glory of that. That's a wonderful thing. Right, on that note, we should probably bring things to an end for this week. So,
you've still not found a bombshell to finish on, have you?
I know. I've got to find a bombshell at some point. Hopefully, yes. Hopefully next week.
Right, okay.
There'll be some sort of... We'll plan a bombshell.
That's a promise.
We'll plan a pre-planned bombshell for the end of next week's podcast. So thanks, as ever, to Alex for lending us his expertise and his insight. Thanks to Matt Dawson for coming on and giving us his analysis of the marvellous events at Murrayfield, as I continue to say. Thanks to Gav for chipping in as ever. And we shall see you all, or hear you all, or listen to you all next week. Cheers.